Hello and welcome to Macro Speaker Podcast. Speaker Podcast. Alright, that's our theme tune. And I am Renato, also known as Renato, sometimes known as Renato, but today you can just call me Renato. I think we're all okay with that. To my left, maybe, but to my very, very, very left, as in hundreds of kilometers away, is Gwyn Campbell, right?
Is it hundreds of kilometers away?
Yeah. You're in a different time zone, man. Technology. Oh, wait. Are you not in Macro's World Convention just yet?
Very smooth. Very smooth. No, not yet, but I'll be leaving in a couple of days.
All right.
So, yeah, this is Gwyn Campbell, otherwise known as Torturer on the Boards. How are you going, Renato?
I'm okay. This is our second Skype cast in a week since our last one, so it's getting very regular, and I'm losing sleep. I think I'm doing okay. God, it's a tough job to be talking about Macross every weekend, huh?
The things we do, yeah. You know. And it's been, I think we need to point out, a really great summer for events, especially art exhibits, which is one of the reasons we're doing this, because we keep going to see these small events or exhibits and we haven't had time to really sit down and talk about them. Previously, this summer, we had the Okawara exhibit, which we should probably talk about at one point, even though it's not Macross. It's kind of good. It was good. There was the Art of Gundam exhibit, which was at the very top of the Mori Tower in Roppongi Hills, which was kind of a big deal. And just today, I went to the Art of Cobra exhibit. I got to see lots of Buichi Terasawa work.
Kobura, na 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 na, Kobura. Hey, how long is that running?
It runs until the 3rd of November, I say, as I recall. Yes, the 3rd of November, I believe.
Okay, I gotta make it over there. Actually, Cobra was the subject of one of my lessons last week.
You did a lesson on Cobra?
I did a lesson on Cobra. Nobody, I think. Maybe one or two people in my class had heard of Cobra or Buichi Terasawa, so that's interesting. And this is a mixed audience, right? So it's both Japanese and foreigners in the class. Yeah.
And Cobra's had some more recent iterations as well. Cobra, the animation, the TV series, and the OVA.
That's
they
like
only
10
go
years
back...
old now.
No, that's like 4 years old.
No.
It was like 2010 to 2011, I think, was the last animated Cobra.
Oh,
I've forgotten
right.
What
yeah,
format
yeah, you're
it was.
Right, you're right. Yeah.
But yeah, lots of exhibits. The other one, of course, being the Shungaten, which I went to, which I won't go into detail here, but is worth a look.
We talked about this a little bit last week as well. The book is like, how many pages? 600 pages?
630 pages.
630 pages. And how expensive was the book? It's only like 4,000 yen, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Kawamori exhibition at Takarazuka in Hyogo Prefecture, that I believe is still running, the book is, let me check, 50 pages long. I was expecting a lot more stuff in there. But
how much was it?
It was a bit of a small... How much was it, actually? I don't remember. Was it 1,000 yen or 2,000 yen?
It's like 1,000 yen. I bought a bunch of them.
I guess that's kind of a fair deal. I don't know. 50 seems still quite thin.
I think it's a fair deal if you look at the cost. I wanted more, and there was a lot more in the exhibit. So I was prepared to pay more if there was more content. But there wasn't.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll go into that in a minute. So, we are, of course, devoting this whole episode to the Henkei. Because that's what it's called. The Henkei.
The transformation.
No, the transform.
According to the book.
I've got the book right in front of me. It tells me to transform, so why should I argue with it? It also says that it has illustration galleys. And the animation design work apostrophe S. So I'm not going to argue with that. It's the holy floating head. So the Henkei is Shoji Kawamori's first individual exhibition. all of Shogun's work.
Is it his first ever one, or just the first one we're aware of?
I think it's said that it's his first ever one. I think it was written down in the introduction. Kojin no tennankai wa hajimete no keiken desu.
Okay,
so my first experience with my own individual.
Right,
exhibition.
So it's the first one dedicated to him, as opposed to, you know, one of the Macross events or an Aquarian event.
Aquarium. 16,000 yen.
What is in that tea you're drinking?
I don't know.
So this exhibit, where's it at, Renato?
We're in Takarazuka, specifically the Tezuka Osamu Museum. The infamous Tezuka Osamu Museum, because we already talked about it at length in a podcast, which was many years ago now. It feels like forever ago that we had the Hyogo Hammer. What is that, like episode 5 or something like that?
It was a while back, but it was a long cast. But yeah, people may remember the venue because they did Macross the Museum down there.
Macross the Museum. I never actually went to that one. I went to the later one that they had at the museum in Miyagi Prefecture, at the Ishinomori Shotaro Museum.
Right, right.
Yeah. But I had been, of course, to the Osamu Tezuka Museum. So I knew where it was. I used to live in Kansai, for those that don't know. So I'd been there a couple of times, maybe just once. I've been there at least once, and it was very impressive. For those that don't know who Osamu Tezuka is, Google and Wikipedia are your friends. All you need to know is that he is the god of manga and anime, and it's still fascinating how much output of work that man made and how much influence he had on the whole of the pop culture industry here in Japan. All of the contents industry is basically based on what he did back in the 1950s and 60s.
And so, despite what people may have you know, many of the methods he set up for making TV animation were not done with any malicious intent in mind. He was just about getting animation made and getting it made fast.
Who's talking about malicious intent?
Well, everyone blames the current hardships of animators and low salaries and high amount of work demands. A lot of articles try to link it back to the processes he set in place 40 to 50 years ago.
Well, it is... Yeah, I mean, I'll agree with you with the malicious intent, but it did set a precedent, basically.
Oh, right? It did.
That he undersold the production of Tetsuma Atomu, believing that he could make money back by licensing out the content, which is still what animation does today, right? Hence, ridiculous, like, shaving foam with Evangelion robots on it or whatever.
Hey, I shave like Gendo. I don't know about you.
I don't. I shave like Rey.
Don't want to go there.
Anyway, where do we want to go? We want to go to Takarazuka, right? Hyogo. All right. So, the last time that I was at this museum, though, was, I think, over 10 years ago. Or maybe around 10 years ago. It had not changed much. it's quite interesting that I think it's funded by, at least partly, by the city of Takarazuka, right? I planned my trip around the museum, but I also went over to Osaka to visit the Firebomb Bar, at which I recorded a segment for this podcast, which I don't know, you might use, you might not, doesn't matter. It does matter, actually, because it's got Mr. Sketchily and the two Howards.
And lots of talk about immigration processes.
Yes, we get to the hard facts here at Macro Speaker Podcast. Some people listen to Fox News. We're not as fictitious. Anyway.
So you went down to Takarazuka, to Osaka, which is a long slog from Tokyo.
Yeah. But it was fun. like I said, I did other things as well. Went over to Universal Studios Japan too.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, if I don't know how much time you have to go down to Osaka to experience Back to Fuji Japan, but you should go before October 31st, because that's when the Halloween period is. And Universal Studios Japan is the last place in the world where you can experience the Back to the Future ride. I will say this. I went there in the morning and in the evening. In the evening, after 6 p.m., they enter the scary mode. And, like, you know, it starts to get dark and there's zombies walking around and they try to scare you. But then if you go into some of the rides, they actually change the content of the rides as well. So you're going into Back to the Future and then some weird stuff happens that you're like, what the hell? Duck Brown! Duck Brown! Duck, duck, come in, duck! And it's quite amazing. I won't spoil it, but it's really, really cool. Like,
I
who's going to listen to
there,
this?
I was down there earlier this year for the Cool Japan stuff they did. So Attack on Titan, Evangelion in 4D, which was really good. Some Monster Hunter stuff. There was a Resident Evil survival game. That's all good. It's all finished now, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, we have Halloween. Anyway, so what we're trying to say is Osaka is cool. We love Osaka. Kyoto is cool too. Kansai is cool.
And Hi-Fi Bomber.
Yeah. Hi-Fi Bomber is always full of cool guys. Okay. Right. So onto the museum itself. So I walked in, and as I said, it's exactly the same as it was 10 years ago. Nothing has changed. That statue of the phoenix that they have outside, I remember looking a lot shinier, a lot more lively last time I saw her. The statue of Atom, Astro Boy, that's inside, also has seen better days. But it's all good. It's all nice. I like that it's all set up in this kind of retro-future style with all the exhibits in, like, funny glass cases, like glass capsules, rather.
Yeah, the display cases are all very, very much art deco, retro-futuristic. Everything's curved, pretty much. And that's really great.
Some of the computers are, like, boxy, like, light bulb, colored light bulbs and stuff like that, which is very, very 50s.
And that's all on the ground floor.
Yeah, because the ground floor is a permanent exhibition, like, about Tezuka's life and stuff like that. If you go down to the lower ground floor, then you've got some hands-on animating experience stuff that you can do. Did you do any of that?
I've never actually stuck around to look at the Tezuka stuff in the Tezuka Museum.
This is the thing, right? I went there with my wife. I don't know how, but I know that I arrived at 12 midday and I left at 5 p.m. I was there for 5 entire hours somehow. It's quite breathtaking.
Now, how much of that was at the Henke?
I would say half and half.
Half and half?
Yeah, because when you're on the lower ground, on the lower floors, there's like movies you can watch as well. So it takes a lot of time. And we read everything. I wouldn't even say I'm a Tezuka fan. I'm just like really fascinated by him. It's almost like saying, like, if you like music, then you're a big Beatles fan. Like, everyone knows how influential the Beatles are. So it's even kind of weird to say that you're a fan, right? So I just felt that I had to read everything about this guy. So I read all of the panels. I read all the things. And we did the animation as well. Because the first time I went there, again, 10 years ago, the animation computer things were broken. Like, you could only do a 2-frame animation, and they have the option to do a 5-frame animation as well. Like, they loop it, right? So this time I went all out and did 5 frames, and that took about an hour as well, or maybe 45 minutes or something. So more respect for actual animators working in the industry, because, you know.
And we must point out, we didn't go down here at the same time. You went down, a week before me.
I went at the, the beginning of, when did I go? Beginning of September, maybe?
Yeah, I was there on September 12th and 13th, the Saturday and the Sunday, and I think you were there the middle of that week. Because you were still you got to Tokyo the day I went.
Yeah, we were there, I was just leaving, just as you had arrived, right? You went on a night bus or something.
And there's a reason
for
that.
And you said, I've just arrived, Because I saw that post on Facebook. You said, okay, I'm in Osaka now. And I was just about to leave to catch my Shinkansen back or something.
Right.
Yeah. Well, anyways, so, yeah.
You planned your trip there around a few other things. In my case, there's a small backstory to it in that this exhibit's on. Is it still ongoing? I don't know, actually.
It's still on, I think.
It's running for a few months. And so I was thinking, I might go down during a public holiday or later on. I was in no rush because I'd kept tabs on any announcements through the fan club or through the official Macross website. And all the signals were that Kawamori was really busy. He's obviously busy with Delta at the moment.
Delta!
He had one signing event down there the day they opened, which was like a weekday. So yeah. I thought, there's no events, I'll go down whenever. Then in August, as people who know me may remember, or maybe they don't particularly care, I was pretty much sick the entire month. It was terrible. And in the middle of this period, I got an email from Hisame, and hi Hisame, saying, go and check the museum website, not the Macross fan site. Because on the museum website, they have news saying that they're going to do a bunch of Kawamori events. And everything is a draw. You've got to put your name in for all of these events to have any hope of getting in. It's very limited. Just you know, do it and try your luck. So I did it and then went back to my fever-induced sleep. And, you know, they said the results would come in on September 4th. So I did remember that.
September 4th?
By them. Yes.
Well, so they give you 1 week to prepare your entire cross-country trip.
Oh, it gets worse.
Oh, my God.
So they said the results would come in.
Why is it always so hard?
There's always a drama, or it wouldn't be a Macross event.
Exactly.
So on September 4th, I checked my email and nothing. You know, so I was like, oh, well, yeah, I gave it a try. That's that. The 4th was a Friday. What I didn't realize was they only notified people who didn't win anything via email. The rest they sent a postcard to, a physical postcard, which took the weekend to get to me. So I got home from work on the night of that following Monday.
Over technology.
I know, on the 7th. And I got this postcard saying I'd won a ticket to go to this Kawamori talk show. And I was like, well, I guess I'm going to Osaka next weekend. I had to suddenly look at overnight buses and hotel. There was only like one hotel I could find in the entire city that was still left open at such a late date. Now, they were having three different events. They were doing another signing, which was just you line up, you can get the booklet from the exhibit signed. That was it. They were doing a talk show, which was an 80-minute lecture on his design theory. And both of those were limited to about 40 people, I believe. And then the final thing was something I'd never heard of or before. They were calling it a night museum. And 20 people, two groups of 20.
Starring Ben Stiller.
Yeah, I know, right?
Because that's the actual Japanese title here in Japan of Night at the Museum.
Night Museum.
Night Museum. Sorry.
So we had two groups of 20 people, two sessions, and each of these 20 people groups got a private tour of the exhibit by Kawamori himself. It's just, he's just there. It's like, hey, and we just get into a group and we go around. But I'll get more into that later. But so I applied for all of these, and when I get this postcard, I've won all of them. Because honestly, if I'd only gotten into one, even if it was the Night Museum, I would have been like, it's, you know, it's hundreds of dollars. You know, going down, coming back, that's like 70-80 bucks each way by bus, maybe 80 to 100 bucks for one night at the hotel, all the other expenses, you know, it's not cheap, especially at such short notice. But I'd gotten into all of them, and one thing I found when I got down there was no one else had won passes to all three of these events. No one. Several people, including the number one Macross fan, hadn't won any. And I met three people, I think, who got into the talk show and the signing, or the Night Museum and the signing, but no one got into all three. And even Kawamori commented at one point. But we'll get into that. First, though, let's talk about this exhibit.
Okay. Let's talk about the exhibit then. Well, the exhibit only took up maybe like half of the second floor. So there's three floors in the museum. There's the lower ground floor where all the animation stuff is, the one that you can experience being an animator. The first floor, which is just all about Tezuka's life and works. And then you go upstairs, and that's where Kawamori's exhibition begins. The first thing you see when you go into when you go up the stairs is the VF1S 1/6 mock-up just looking at you, right?
Right. It's hanging there. It's in an enclosed space. There are windows to the side so you can get a side view, but
yeah,
it's kind of like almost a black photo booth diorama kind of thing.
Yeah. And everyone's seen the photographs by now, hopefully. At least, you know, if you downloaded this from Microsoft, there's probably some photographs there of the exhibition.
There will be.
Yeah. So,
but what do you think of it?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, yeah, there it is. Yeah.
So it's a Girl Walk 1S, and it was quite nice. There were a few mistakes in it, according to some fans I talked to. Apparently, the number of slots in the air intake, they either had one too many or one too few.
Are you kidding me with this?
Slots? No, no, I'm not. I was talking to some people. They're like, "Yep, yep," and we're gonna give them crap about the Night Museum. It's like, okay. So yeah, and apparently, because the Night Museum was supposed to be the first one, was talking about his which one was it? How? One was about his designs, and the other one was about his creative process. So the first one was more technical, and the second one was more about his creative process. And you can only go to one. I went for the creative process because that interested me more.
Yeah.
And apparently in the first one, the design one, they go up those stairs, stop in front of the 1S, someone points out one or two mistakes, and they wasted like half of their session in front of that 1S talking about it. Waste is probably
how long was
term.
It?
It's a 1 hour.
So they were half an hour in front of the first thing, and then they had rush.
I heard it was over 20 minutes.
My God.
So that was because he was like, oh, yeah, now that you mention it. And they went to all this talk on a 1S girl walk as opposed to all the other art.
Well, you know what? Because I have such a bad memory, especially when it comes to like these tiny details and stuff. I remember looking, like you said, that there's a couple of windows that you can see it from behind and from the back, from the side and from the back, right, from behind.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the one from the side, you can see underneath the wings, right? And there was something, right. I remember there something about the hard points under the wings. Like there's more than there's supposed to be, like there's four or something like that, and I'd never seen any illustration that showed four or anything like that. Anyway, like it doesn't matter, but I remember noticing that, and just like the idea that of course someone else is going to notice them, and they're going to be even more anal about it and just start complaining about it to somebody.
And he oversaw the design himself. There were pictures that went up before the exhibit opened.
Yeah, but he's probably always retconning anyway, so you know, that's probably his excuse. True. I don't know, it doesn't really matter. The cockpit, I wonder if it fit Hot Toys figures. What they should have done to make it an interactive exhibit is have it open, and everyone can bring their Batman and, Avengers figures or Spider-Man or whatever. I've got Marty McFly, so he can go back in time, 88 miles an hour. In a VF1 is. So, well, anyway, so you walk through, and there's a bunch of, big statues, just like the 1S, right? And some of them had been at other events before, like at the satellite booth in Anime Japan and things like that. Some of them we'd seen quite recently, actually, because we did a podcast a few months back at the Suginami Animation Museum, where they had an Aquarian exhibition. And they had those large statues of, I think, both aquariums, right? The Evil and the Original. Mm-hmm. So they had those there. They also had the Fool, Nobunaga the Fool robot there. And there were TV screens playing the openings of all of the shows, or most of the shows, that he was mainly involved with All right. So then that kind of introductory area with all the media playing on the screens and the giant statues, that's the photo area. And then you go down this passage where you start to get the exhibition proper. And the first couple of exhibits are like photographs of his kind of workshop, as it were. I know that they're all photographs that were taken at different time periods, because you can tell from what's in the background, right? There are VHS or Betamax boxes or crates in the background, some of them. That's clearly an 80s photograph. And then the latest Kawamori, well, it's all Kawamori, I mean, Aquarian stage design things. You can see that the background clearly looks like the inside of Satellite Studio. So they're obviously from different time periods, but it's
correct. They were showing how he was working with both Lego and paper
and putty
models
and stuff like that. Yeah,
and stuff. Yeah,
yeah. So he works not just on paper, but also he uses materials to craft things in three dimensions and make sure that all the transformations work correctly or not. And so you had some stuff that had never been displayed before.
Like a putty version of the Grampus from Blue Submarine Number 6.
Yes.
A broken version.
See, I told
version,
you worked
but
on it. Wasn't there some other podcast where you said Blue Submarine?
I asked what he contributed to it.
Yeah, I don't remember. But it was that. There you go.
So. It was the Grampus. It's in the book, too.
It is, you're right. Yes. Get to that. And then when you turn round the corner, it's just wall after wall after wall of rough sketches. Like literally the entire walls, almost the entire walls from floor to ceiling are covered in, well, basically they're copies, really. Copies of these, rough pencil sketches, and they're all slightly different, but they all lead to the finalized design. Mostly the colored originals are in frames, but everything else is basically just stuck to the wall.
And when we say the framed originals, it's not like all those are the final versions. They had all the different design concepts he had for Aquarian, and wow, there are a lot of them.
Aquarian! I'm going to do that every time.
So there was a lot of Aquarian. It started off with mostly Nobunaga and Aquarian, which the Aquarian stuff was interesting for reasons I'll get into later, stuff he told me. But lack of Macross from the outset, but, you know, that was to be expected at this kind of exhibit.
Lacross.
Lack of Macross.
Macross.
Macross. So we go through the Aquarian stuff.
And Yeah. Like you said, like there's all these different concepts. I remember reading something interesting about that, about the whole concept behind the Aquarian, but I don't remember what it actually was.
Well, I've got some anecdotes I'll get to later, but let's just finish the walkthrough first, I guess. Because next from after the Aquarian, they had original Macross designs right next to Macross Frontier designs.
Yeah, it's kind of weird the way they organize this, because it's not in chronological order.
Or IP order or any order.
It's kind of IP order in that they kept the Macross stuff together for the most part, but then you go through the... Well, like you said, Macross Zero and Macross... No, Macross Frontier and the original Macross are there at the beginning, and then you go through most of the rest of the exhibition, and Macross 7 and Macross Plus are at the end. So,
well, you had Macross Zero, then Armored Core, then Macross Plus, then like Omega Boost before you got to Thunderbirds and Macross 7.
Thunderbirds?
Yeah, they had the sketch for the design he did for Thunderbirds.
Oh, okay. So, one thing that we should mention about this... Because from here on in, this is going to be chaos, right? Okay, so I'll just mention that they had different sections, and it was laid out interestingly enough. But there's one corner which they swapped out every week, or at least every couple of weeks. So obviously they had the Thunderbird stuff while you were there, when Howard was there, he said that there was Ambassador Magma, the transformable version. Was it?
Yeah. This is the glass cabinet we're talking about?
Yes,
tucked
yes,
in the corner
yes.
at the end? Right.
Yeah. When I went there, and this isn't in the book, by the way, they had preliminary designs for a bunch of stuff. Most notably, X-Bomber. Not Fire Bomber, but X-Bomber, which became Starfleet, Starfleet, send a message out to Earth Control. You know?
What is in that tea?
It's getting browner by the minute. The guitarist from Queen, Brian May, he sang the theme tune to Starfleet, the marionette show about...
So talking about Macross Frontier...
No, we're not. We're not. Starfleet, it's a thing. You know who's a big... Oh, you know what? All right. I'll get to that later on, I guess.
I'm just returning to the order we were, you know, walking through them.
Well, so... I'm not going to remember the order. Seriously, it's chaos, right? It's not in any order, really, so I can't remember any of it. So you'll have to guide me, as Kawamori guided you.
We've got the guidebook here as well, or the pamphlet as well, which is not
which
in
is
the order.
Also not in any order.
In any order at all. It's bizarre. The thing about the Macross Frontier stuff they had is that they had the original, the blue color scheme, sorry, the white with blue highlight version of the 25.
Yeah.
And that just reminded me once again, every time I see that design, that I vastly prefer that than the way it turned out.
Oh,
like,
really?
That sketched look that it gets, once it went to be sharper and in CG and more sleek.
Oh, you're talking about just that drawing then?
Yeah, I've always loved that drawing.
Okay.
I
thought you meant like the actual paint job, because it appeared in the animation like that just one time, right? When they did the preview for the show, before the show actually aired, it didn't look at all like Osmus Valkyrie ended up looking. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't grey with the Roifokker kind of thing, it was white with that blue stripe.
Has that been included on any extras with anything?
Good question. I don't know, because I never bought a single Frontier DVD.
Ouch!
Macross Wow!
Well, you do have the Shooting Star box set, correct?
Yeah, but I didn't buy it. They gave it to me because
shh!
What? I can't talk about it? What can I talk about?
Well, no, actually, you know, that's something we actually need to podcast about, because no one recorded us at Macross Worldcon last year, apparently. I'm going to ask again this year when I'm there, but... Look, I digress. Next to that, they had, on the opposite wall, a bunch of Macross Zero
stuff.
I did buy
one. I bought Nyan Kuri, the music video.
Okay.
So I'm doing my part.
So Macross Zero, because you know they never brought out a book for Zero with these.
Yes, they announced designs. One, but they never actually made it.
They had a bunch on this wall. They could have had more, but they had a few.
What's funny is that every time I see that line art from Macross Zero, it's always really pixelated. For some random reason. And this is the first time that I've seen it in good quality.
And it looked nice.
Yeah, In fact, you can't even see line art like that. Like, most of the Macross Zero Valkyries are always in CG. Like, the Chronicle, I think, doesn't have line art, does it? I can't check.
I don't
think
it's
upstairs.
Does.
I know that the line art that they used in the book that came with Macross 30, which we also were involved in, by the way, doesn't have it. They have CG stuff for both the Frontier and the Macross Zero stuff.
Right. One thing I noticed, taking a step back, some of the early
Aquarian
designs looked like a hybrid of what would you call it? Of an Armored Core Valkyrie with the reactive armor from a VF Zero.
Yeah, because it's the same stance, it's the same kind of proportions, really.
And the Aquarian had like almost like Gundam style gun tank guns or gun cannon guns coming off its shoulders.
Yeah, yeah, because those were like the legs of one of them,
and they
popping up from
guns.
The back, right? Yeah, and there's others that where the legs are spread out and they look like they're kind of wings. So it looks like a. I mean, that looks like a different kind of Gundam, right? A more modern one.
Right, this is all on page 11 of the book, by the way.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now, because there's no way I can remember all this. I have the toy. of the aquarium. Oh, I remember what I wanted to say about the aquarium now. Yeah, okay. So they have the original aquarium designs right at the beginning of the exhibit. Later on, they have Aquarian Evil designs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because what he wanted to achieve with Aquarian, and I think this was like obvious from the outset, we don't really need it as part of the explanation, but it's get a robo, but with a believable transformation, like a real-world transformation thing that could actually be made into a toy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, with Aquarian Evil, if you look at his comment next to the actual exhibits, he said, well, you know, we decided to brush up the original Aquarian design because we figured out that with the way that it worked, the transformations, we couldn't make the toy stand up by itself. And if you have the toy, and I do, it's a piece of garbage. It is the floppiest toy I've ever seen in my life, so top-heavy, there is no way that thing would ever fly. And so you can't stand up the toy unless you've got the stand. And it's not like the stand design is attractive or anything, it's just a black triangle of plastic. It's awful. So, I mean, it's a fun enough toy to play around with, but if you want to pose it, forget about it. So, he said, yeah, so that's why I redesigned the Aquarian ever so slightly, so that it's never top-heavy in any of its modes, if you notice the difference between the original and the Evil one. Because it's a bunch of stuff that goes onto the hips, right, that would, in the original, have been on the shoulders or, like, the top back. But I'm reading that, and I'm thinking, oh, yeah, really? You want to make it a better toy? Because that's what he wrote, like, to make it easier for Shōhin Tenkai, right, for merchandising.
Mm-hmm.
How many merchandising projects did you see come off of Aquarian Evil? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
right?
So, well, figures, that was it.
Yeah, figures, and they made one robot which was not transformable. It was the Super Robot Shogokin, the tiny one.
Oh, okay.
So, like, what the hell? Thanks. Well, over to you. I'm done.
Yeah. Renato steps off the soapbox, puts it to one side. So next to the Macross Zero stuff, we had a lot, almost too much, Armored Core.
Yeah. There was a whole entire wall that was twice or three times as long as the Aquarian wall. And this one was, from floor to ceiling, full of just Armored Core designs that all look the same to me. I'm sorry. When you've just... It's almost like it's spewing a bunch of designs at me. And I'm like, it's too much to take in. So
I'm entirely on the same page.
It didn't
a lot of them looked very similar. There were one or two, you know, key designs that were used for cover art. And these were mostly designs, I think, from the early PlayStation 1 era.
Yeah.
Armored Core. So I think the interesting thing in them was they're all presented in far more detail than they appeared in the actual game, given how blocky.
Oh, yeah, because of the low-res polygons and stuff.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that he doesn't really... Did he go into detail with that? Because I know that he went into detail regarding designing something around a low polygon count when he talked about Omega Boost.
He did. He gave a few comments, but I was thinking of waiting till we do our initial, like, let's talk through the end of the event, then I'll double back and give his comments. How's
okay,
that?
Well, as I say, I don't know what order these things are in, so let's just go through the book. How about we go through the book?
Well, hey, I can go from memory on this.
Oh my god. All right, well, one thing that I should point out, that throughout this whole exhibit, there's not just stuff on the walls. I mean, granted, it was mostly about his designs and his evolution, or rather their evolution, from rough concepts to finalized designs. But there are other physical objects on display in glass cases as well. So, like the Takara toys of Diaclone, the little cars from Cyber Formula and stuff like that. So every so often when we talk about something, usually it's there's some physical representation of it somewhere on display. And it's quite small, but they're all... Most of the big ones, most of the big projects have at least one product on display, right? So for Armored Core, they had the White Glint kit, I think, right? In the corner somewhere.
I remember they had a kit. I wasn't paying much attention to it.
Yeah, it's the White Glint one that... the one that the Howl Animation School used for their commercials a few years back.
Oh, I actually do remember that.
Yeah.
So they had, as you mentioned, Cyber Formula was represented, but they actually had more toy cars than they actually had art on the wall.
Yeah, I thought that was weird. You know, coming off of that whole wall spewing of nothing but Armored Core, it's really just a bunch of stuff. And they had even less for Crusher Joe.
Well, you know what they had, not necessarily less of, but something you were more likely to miss, was what was to the right of the Cyber Formula stuff.
Which was
some holes in the wall.
Yeah, the Blue Submarine number 6.
Yeah, which was hit. They had a double-layered wall with holes, which I can only think were supposed to be like bubbles in water, and you look to see the art semi-dark and secluded on the wall behind.
It's almost like he was ashamed of it.
Oh, I love the Grampus design, though.
It's quite smart. Yeah, and I remember reading... he made... Because he's got written comments for all of these pieces. And he was saying that he couldn't come up with a clever concept, and then he stumbled across like a manta ray or something, and he said, well, it'd be cool if that could be replicated. I think it's in the book.
It was good to see some Blue Submarine number 6 stuff there, but it was... I knew they were trying to be... give you some variation, something different, but the first time I walked through the event, I completely missed that wall.
Yeah. I almost did too.
So we also had, and even though this was only a tiny part of a corner, we did have some Omega Boost. And I was so happy about that, because I love the Omega Boost designs. However, I don't own any Omega Boost books or anything, and this was the first time I'd seen the designs with the backpack removed from the Omega Boost. Because, you know, the defining thing about the Omega Boost in action as a robot is that distinctive cross for the boosters on the back.
Yeah.
And the gun that then comes down to its shoulder.
I don't know. That looks way, way too similar to the round... Oh, man, what do you call it? The round something. Round vernier or something? No, that's Vifem. The round something from Votoms. Like if Tim's listening.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's the same design.
Yeah. It is very, very similar, yeah.
Yeah.
But, well, as a mecha, that's... I in the game, it never appears without it on.
No, of course
except
not.
For the opening, the very opening CG movie, you see it walk into the tunnel where they slap it on.
Yeah.
But you don't really notice it. And throughout the whole game, the impression is it's part of it. But seeing it with it removed, it's like... It's really weird.
It looks more human. It looks like a guy in a suit.
Well, the top half of it almost looks like a really, really big Pat Labor with giant shoulders. And the bottom half looks like legs from a Metal Gear or something. Like, they're very humanoid legs with very little detail. They're just black.
Well, he explained that too, like, in the comment, if I remember correctly. Robots that are meant for space flight have really no reason to have huge legs. The reason why most robot designs have huge legs is so that they can stand firmly on the ground, so they have a lower center of gravity. But since this guy is supposed to be just be flying around the whole time, it doesn't make sense. So he made the legs slender. I believe that's the reason.
So around the area where Omega Boost was, they also had a bunch of these designs he did for commercial products, for like car companies. So there was the Subaru EyeSight, which was the transforming robot into a helicopter thing.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
Further on, they had the Aibo, of course. They had the recent transforming Miku, the racing team car, Miku Racing Team.
Yeah, which is, I don't know.
the transformed. There was that other one as well. What was it? The car that transformed into a robot to get past traffic?
That's the Nissan thing, isn't it?
I think so. I'm flicking through the book hurriedly here trying to find
it. No, it's in there. It's not in there as an article as far as I can see, but it's in the color pages at the start. It's the Dualis powered suit.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember the name now.
So, I don't know about you, but all of the preliminary designs are much cooler than the final design.
Agreed 100%. Agreed 100%.
Like, what is... I mean, I know that's not him. You know, it's someone high up in Nissan or whatever. Is this Nissan? I don't even remember.
It's page 15 on the book, yeah.
They're like, no, change it. It's got to be more smooth, more whatever. The first couple of designs make it look like what it's supposed to look like, which is a guy in a suit, right? A robot suit.
Mm-hmm.
One of the intermediary designs is a guy inside a car that has arms and legs.
It's like the car itself, the main bulk of it becomes a pod, like in Gundam, a ball, kind of, with legs and arms on it.
Yeah, yeah. Almost like a Gerwalk car, but like if the proportions were way off.
Right. I'm wondering if there's much influence from Basquatch in here.
From Basquatch?
Well, wasn't Basquatch around the same... This was 2007, so Basquatch would have been around this time, wouldn't it?
I don't know.
Like... Because he and Thomas Romain were doing Basquatch together, I think, around this time.
I guess.
And that was all, you know, cars, yeah, as but robots.
I don't see it. I don't think it is that, because this, I don't know.
Well, just this middle one in this book, showing it in the cockpit, that's very reminiscent of a Basquatch design, in my opinion. I mean, I'm not saying it in a...
For me, it's reminiscent of some way. SF illustrations that you would see in old 80s magazines.
True, and I'm not saying this in a plagiarizing kind of way, just
working
together,
right.
I'm wondering how much there's some interplay with
the influence. There was probably some, because, you know, these guys are working on these projects all at the same time, so there's obviously going to be some, it's not, you know, on purpose, and probably subliminal crossover.
Right, right.
And then, of course, you've got the final design, which is so... Like, I think it's clever. It's cleverer than what the final actual film makes it out to be. Because if you look closely, the thing that ends up looking like just a regular robot, there's like glass casings, and inside you can see the face of the driver and like his hands and his legs and stuff. But, I mean, that's not visible in the final commercial. So all you can see in the commercial is that this car drives down a tunnel and comes out and it's a robot now. It doesn't feel like a powered suit. In fact, if this wasn't titled Powered Suit Dualis, I would just think it's a robot. Oh, it's a Transformer. That's
Transformer,
it.
Yeah.
Completely losing the entire concept. And he was like, oh, you know, because there are Transformers, and, you know, didn't want to make it a typical Transformer design. So I put the headlights on the arms. That's a rare design, isn't it? No one's ever seen that before, so I did that. And, like, but...
You know what else
one,
I had
there?
There
is one shot in the commercial where you do see the close-up of the guy's face inside the head of the robot.
Mm-hmm.
But it's literally blink and you've missed it. And it's only one of the many variants of the commercials, at least that I've seen. So it's really a waste of time.
You know, it's interesting. This exhibit actually gave me pause to examine and think about those kind of collaboration projects he does. Because often they come up in the news like, well, he's helped do a car or he's helped do something for Miku. And it's a promotional thing. It's obviously work he's been contracted to do. So it doesn't always have the spirit of originality, but and as a result I guess I tend to overlook them often. I'll watch the TV commercial, whatever it is, once, and that's it. But I stood there and watched these commercials, especially the helicopter robot,
the Subaru EyeSight.
I watched that over and over because they had like a series of 5 or 6 commercials. I didn't know they did so many.
I didn't even know when they ran. Did they run on TV, or is it like,
I think they were net like webisode kind of things.
Yeah.
And they were quite good. Yeah, I had a good time.
They're okay. I wish they had higher definition versions, because some of them were, you know, pixelated as hell.
Well, you want higher definition versions. They were playing the original PlayStation 1 opening for Omega Boost, and it looked horrendous because of the compression on that movie file. The actual gameplay looked better.
Is it? Oh, yeah, the gameplay, yes, 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 it is. Yes.
Because, you know,
because those files are, well, MPEG, like, one.
They're compressed to hell, and yeah, much like, you know, the opening for the PlayStation.
They're designed to play on a CD, for God's sake.
Well, much like the opening to the Do You Remember Love game on the Sega Saturn.
Looks like it was shot through gauze or something.
The best version we'll get is 480. 480i at that.
Yeah. Well, they're on Blu-ray now. The Do You Remember Love stuff.
Right.
It's still not technically HD, but...
Right, it has those huge borders around it.
Yeah, yeah. But it's okay.
Well, you know what else they had at this exhibit, Renato?
No.
Gunhead!
Yes.
The worst movie I'd seen.
What is it? Party Time Gunhead or something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
Gunhead, I remember I rented it about 10 years ago. I don't remember it apart from just, like, half of it is randomly in English, half of it is Japanese.
Well, it was so heavily hyped when it came out on VHS back in the day, and much like the Pat Labor live-action movies, they had this great prop. They were all about the physical effects, and then everything surrounding it when you saw the finalized product was... I want to say trash. Terrible.
Well, it could have been worse. Yeah, because, again, going by his comments, it was a really start, stop, start again, stop again planning of a project. They called him on to say, hey, do you want to work on this live-action robot show? And he was like, yeah, okay. Why don't we make it like this? Why don't we make it like that? And they were like, oh, that's too hard. We can't do it. And then it stopped. And then he's like, all right, well, I've got another idea. Why don't we make it like an exosuit, you know? So the guy goes inside. So basically like the Nissan Dualis thing that we just talked about.
Right.
And they're like, oh, you know, I don't know about that, blah, blah, blah. And Kamori's like, look, if we don't do it now, somebody is going to do it before. You know, probably he's remembering how he got stung with the chicken walkers from Star Wars, you know, because he had the idea for the Wriggles and the Go Walks and stuff like that, you know? And everyone said, no, I don't know. And then he saw it on Star Wars, and he was like, God damn it, they got it before I did. And then the same thing happened. Why? Because Aliens came out, and the Power Loader was there. So he was like, damn, the Power Loader. See, I told you, they beat us. So let's just go with my idea. And they're like, okay, what do you want to do? And like, all right, let's just have a tank that transforms into a robot.
And the transformation, I never realized. In the movie, kind of slowly rises. You don't really realize it's turning into a robot.
I know. Movie is so dark anyway, you can't see anything.
That's true. That is true.
Didn't help that I saw it on VHS, yeah.
They had two huge, like, figures of it there. Well, models, I guess, of the gun.
I think those were the recent kits, because Kotobukiya brought out one.
Right, they did that launch event over in Akihabara where they had all the art up for it.
Yes. Well, didn't they had a one-to-one, like they had the prop, didn't they? In Shinjuku or somewhere.
They had a fair bit of artwork for it there. Well, yeah, as much as you can expect, what, 3-4 pieces. And that was pretty good. But
what did you think of the other preliminary Aibo designs?
The one where he had like a dinosaur?
Yeah, his idea was originally to have an egg that could be recharged. And then the dinosaur or the chicken or whatever would come out of the egg. And then it would go back in the egg to recharge again or something. So he had all these concepts. And then in the end, they said, no, you can't do that. You can't do this. You can't do this.
There are actually good reasons why that didn't happen, but I'll get into that in a minute. Let's then briefly touch on the Macross 7 designs they had, because some of those surprised me.
Did you not have
most of them?
I had seen most of them, because they were all published in the Kawamori Design Works book. Like the first
one. The silver
ones.
Cover?
No, way before that one. The Shoji Kawamori Macross Design Works book.
Okay.
The first, I would say, you know, 6, 7, maybe 10 pages were all color designs. And most of the bulk of that were endless variations of the Fire Valkyrie in many, many different colors, many different head designs. Some of them were actually wearing goggles. Some of them had hair. Some of them had actual Valkyrie-size guitars. It's really it's more like a Visual K Rock Band thing. I've said this many times, I think, you know, be lucky that, you know, you hardcore Mecha fanatics, be lucky that you got what you did get, because you would have hated this show even more if you'd got some of the more preliminary, earlier preliminary designs.
I must admit, I think my copy of that book is back in Australia. On my bookshelf at the moment, I have the the silver cover one and the Miyatake Design Works one.
Again, the same with me. It's in the UK. I don't have it, unfortunately.
But so this blue version, these blue versions of the 19 with missile packs that are shoulder mounted.
Yeah, that was interesting. I don't remember if they're in the book or not. As I said, there's so many different variants in the other book. But yeah, I think they're there.
They were really cool to see, especially blown up, because they're smaller in the book, we should note.
I should also note that one of the comments that you can see on one of the rough designs showing the close-ups of most of the gimmicks of the VF-19, on the setting where you can see the leg opens up to fire missiles, he said he wrote a little annotation there, it's handwritten, and it says, this is for the toy makers, so you can refer to it when you make the toy. Obviously, they completely ignored that. They're like, oh, yeah, really? Yeah, I think we'll bother. Damn it, Bandai, Bandai! Was put in least amount of effort.
They also had the design that, since this period, I've heard him talk about in talk shows, he said how he was originally working on a transformable monster.
Yeah. And it's here. Like, if you look at the, again, the book, right? So, page...
23?
Maybe, yeah. Well, I guess you're looking at it now. Yeah, page 23. So the Koenig Monster, or what eventually became the Koenig Monster, BB6 Koenig Monster, of course, everyone knows it now from Frontier. You know, it originally appeared in VFX2, right? And it was the brand new mecha. But even in VFX2, it was already like 5 or 6 years old. It was designed for Macro 7. It just never came to fruition then.
Right. And
so
he tweaked it for the game.
Sorry?
He tweaked it for the game. So,
yes,
you know, it was a big thing at the time. But then you hear, you know, he had been working on it for Macro 7, but they never actually saw real animation outside of a video game opening.
So again, 7 did it. 7's done everything. I love the Koenig Monster. Can I just talk about the Koenig Monster just for a second?
Be my guest.
I really love this design. It's so smart and clever, because he made a point in one of the talk events that was streamed on Nico Nico. I think it was the one... I think it was the last one that he did. You know, when he... the one that was streamed at the top floor of the new Radio Kaikan.
The new Radio Kaikan. The Cheryl's birthday one.
Yeah, Cheryl's birthday, where they had the first sneak peek at the YF-19 Advance, or the VF-19 Advance, right? Mm-hmm. So that was a very toy-centric talk, right? So he was messing around with the... that's when he made the Scorpion mode of the Koenig Monster, right? Because they were going to re-release it, the Bandai version. Right. And he was saying, so the interesting thing about this design is that, of course, we all know that Kawamori Designs, part of the design is the actual transformation itself, right? So you can't deviate too much from the transformation if you're going to make a toy out of it. The way that everything moves around is part of that design. and we also know that he often refers to real-life aircraft in his designs. Mm-hmm. And he likes to keep the gimmicks of those aircraft, so that's why the VF-1 has those wings that move around, because the F-14 had that, and then he incorporates it into the transformation. So it's the same thing with the VB6, because where do those arms come from? The side grenade launchers, or whatever they're supposed to be, of the monster, they come from the top of the shuttle, right? Which are the shuttle bay doors. Open the bay doors, Hal. Haruhiko Mikimoto. So they open up in the same way that a typical, like the real space shuttle bay doors open. But that's part of the transformation. So if you look at this preliminary design, you can see them opening up, and then the four cannons that become the top of the monster come out from that as a kind of attack mode of the shuttle. Mm-hmm. And that's very clever. So you're still keeping those bay doors, but they're not used for storage anymore. They're used to hide a massive weapon. And then they become the arms of the robot.
Right.
It's a really, really smart design, and I've always loved the chunkiness of it. So even before, and I'm sure I've mentioned this as well many times, even before Frontier, you know, as soon as I saw that design, I wanted a toy of it, thinking that never in a million years anyone would make it. And then Yamato was giving away, you know, when they were making still VF1s and Macros Plus Valkyries, when we were giving away these questionnaires and please fill them in and we might make the stuff that you want us to make. And so I wrote down, please make a VF4, please make a VA3 Invader or whatever, and then please make the VB6 Koenig Monster. I was thinking that they would never, ever make them. And, well, what do you know, 2005 or 6 came over, and no, 5 or 4, maybe. And they made it, and it's amazing, because there was no show to push at the time. It was just VFX2. Hmm. By that point, a 5 or 6-year-old game. And I loved mine, and it's a crying shame that everyone in Macro's world hates it. And they were like, yeah, the Bandai version is better. Maybe it's more solid, I agree with that. But you know what? If you're willing to just fix the hinges with a little nail polish or whatever, it's a much better rendition, in my opinion, of the design. It's still not perfect. They can still make a version 2, because I don't like the Bandai design at all. In fact, I don't like the way that... that Koenig Monster looks in the Frontier anime either. It doesn't look like it's supposed to.
Well, you can rest assured, Renato, that if Arcadia ever does get around to reissuing it, it'll be at least $100 or $150 more than the last one.
Well, they're not going to reissue it. They'll make it from the ground up. Right. I don't even think they have the rights to that mold. They own that mold anymore. It's a new frontier, dakara moto. I don't know how noisy this is going to be, but welcome to let's just call this Micros Speaker Podcast. right, so I'm here in the Firebomb Bar, which is a bar of Firebomb Brewer. Around me are posters and memorabilia and signed autographed cards by Mikimoto and Chie Kajiura. And Fukuyama, Yoshiki, all these people that had a lot to do with Macross. There's books, there's magazines, there's jigsaw puzzles, there's lots of really crazy toys and stuff everywhere, all related to Macross. And I'm drinking a drink called Heart and Soul. My wife is here, she's drinking a drink called, what is it, just Milen? Just Milen. And I have not one, but two Howards with me today. So go ahead and reintroduce yourselves. You've both been on the podcast before, right?
Me, never. No.
Really?
Never.
All right, well,
first time.
Howard Browning, go ahead.
Howard from Chicago. Yeah, I think I registered from Across World at some point, and I may have posted twice. I don't remember. But you can just call me Howard.
Yeah, I'm Howard. You've heard me before. I'm the guy that talks about all the doujinshi all the time. In fact, I have a little care package for other Howard of various doujinshi I picked up at this comic kit.
Yeah. Lots of nice stuff.
Okay. Well, I'm over here. This is in Osaka, by the way. This is not in Tokyo. We don't get as cool stuff as this. Well, we get all the cool stuff.
You get all the other cool. You get all the cool stuff except for this. This is the one thing we have, like, man. Like, don't take it
give
away.
Give us this one thing. Yeah, all right. You win. You know what really annoys me about this is I lived in Kansai for 6 years, man. There was no firebomb bar when I was here. I move away and all of a sudden, yeah, we're going to have a macro. What's your favorite cartoon? Macro 7? All right, we'll have a bar in the place that you just left.
Thank you.
Yes.
We appreciate your sacrifice.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so I'm here because over in Takarazuka, which is in Hyogo Prefecture, which is where you work, Howard. Yep. Howard One. They have a Kawamori Shoji exhibition. And if you don't know, Kawamori Shoji is the guy who designed the VF1 Valkyrie. You know, you may have heard of it. It was... first of all, why don't we just talk about the exhibition? I assume you've both been probably more than once.
I haven't had a chance yet.
You haven't?
I have a nine-month-old daughter.
I'm sorry.
I'm probably going to go during...
I mean, I'm happy for you. I'm not sorry.
Yeah, of course. But I've seen the book, and it's fantastic. Howard picked up, original Howard picked one up for me when he was there. And, it's fantastic stuff. But so I'm looking forward to going. So why don't you tell me how it was, Renato?
I will do. I want to hear Howard Kawai's experience with it
first. I've been there five or six times because
really?
Every time one of you guys from Tokyo comes over, I go with you guys and show you around.
Okay.
Except when you come during the middle of the week and I work and I can't go with you.
I'm sorry, that's the only time that I can come, though. Okay. So, well, let me tell you my impressions about the Kawamori exhibition. First of all, the name of the Kawamori exhibition was actually the Transformation, right? Which makes it just a small part of Kawamori-san's career, right? Now, Kawamori is not really a household name by any stretch of the imagination in Japan, right? So, first of all, let me begin by saying that it's probably not as complete an exhibition as it should be in terms of explaining who this guy is, right? There wasn't really much information about how he grew up, what his childhood influences were, why he's interested in the things that he's interested in, which would give us a big clue as to, you know, his thinking process behind the designing of all these things. Because he doesn't just design, mecha. He designs worlds and stories within those things. And the mecha that he designs are an intrinsic part of that world, and the two are dependent on each other, right?
Well, for that other information, that's why they were selling the autographed autobiographies there.
I know, but that's a book, you know? So, like, you need a... I don't know, I would have expected a couple of panels first to tell us, who he was, where he came from. First of all, let me explain that this is an exhibition held in the Osamu Tezuka Museum.
Which is really, really tiny.
Yeah.
It's really small. That's a big factor of why they couldn't include his autobiographical information, because there's just not enough space.
Having said that... Mm-hmm. Tia, how long were we there for?
Almost 5 hours.
We were in there for 5 hours.
Wow, 5 hours.
So any bigger would be over my physical limit, you know. I'd have to have my three meals right there. So I think in terms of the sizes, it's not that bad. It's just the fact that they concentrated on a specific part of the career, and I wouldn't mind having had less items on display, but having it be a more, at the risk of it being more shallow, a more kind of concise but comprehensive, just scan across his career. Because you walk out thinking, if you've never heard of Kawamori before, you walk out thinking, well, that guy designed a lot of robots. Mm-hmm. But not really too much context there. Having said that, the pieces that were on display were quite impressive. There was a lot of stuff that had never seen the light of day before, as far as I know. There were you know, for every work that was exhibited, there were a couple of finalized designs, which was the line art that always gets reprinted in every book, whether it's Macross or Aquarion or whatever. But then there's dozens of preliminary rough designs that give you a kind of a narrative as to how you got to the final design there, right? So that was interesting. When you went, Howard, did you notice? I'm sure you noticed, but there's a corner that they apparently change ever so often, right? Which is the never before being released and never used. Yeah, there's a very small archive section that is just basically designs that were never ever finalized or used.
Did they have the Magmataishi when you were there?
No.
So that's how it changed. When I was there,
yeah.
They had the Kawamori designed Magmataishi.
But that's a.
Hello.
Hey. Oh, yeah, Sketchy?
Yes.
Oh, all right then. Hang on. Let me finish my train of thought. But you know what that is I think that a couple of years back at the in Akihabara, the UDX Center, in the anime center shop, they had a kind of a gallery space, and they dedicated like the whole thing basically to a tribute to Osamu Tezuka, where a bunch of artists did their own interpretations of Tezuka's characters and designs and things. And so you had Mikimoto doing what did he do? He did The Princess Knight, right? Rimon no Kishi. And then you had Narumi Kakunoichi, who is the girl from... Well, she was on Macross as well. She worked in Artland for a long time. She does the Tales of series now. I think that's her. She did one of his characters as well. And Kawamori did a Magma Taishi that transforms, right? Was that what was on display?
Yeah.
Okay, then I've seen it. But it's never been reprinted. Yeah, so there's nothing... This is the unfortunate thing. These things are displayed for just a few days, and they never see the light of day again until some other event where they're never, ever announced, really. They're just there again. So that is... that was originally part of this Moe Moso exhibition for Tezuka Osamu, if I remember correctly. We weren't allowed to take photographs, so, you know, no one's. I don't even remember what it looks like. I remember it being there and being very impressive, though.
Right. And another reason they probably did that is because they don't have the space to show everything, so they have to have it on rotation.
Yeah, not just that. I mean, they also want lots of people to come many, many times, as you do. Yeah. So you know, I was thinking, yeah, maybe if I had the chance again, I'd come again because I asked the woman to make me a point card so I get the fourth visit free, right? Which is, I hope, what you did.
Yeah,
of course. Right, so the the other thing is that today I went there and what they had was, and this I've never seen before, preliminary designs for X-Bomber. Bomba! Not that one. X-Bomber is the Thunderbirds-inspired puppet show that became Starfleet, which was a song sung by Brian May of Queen in the British BBC version.
Huh.
Yeah, so it's all related, guys. X-Bomber is just this robot that is kind of like Combatler V. He transforms and is made up of little different vehicles and stuff. That's what it ended up being. That's what it's like on the show, right? It's a tokusatsu show, basically, but with puppets instead of humans. But apparently, Kawamori's idea was just to have him split up into different little robots that also transformed into different vehicles. So those were all the things that were on display there. And there was also a display of his design for a moon base that had a dome over it that looked very Macro 7-y. That I'm not sure, I don't remember the show very well, but I don't think that was there, but I think they borrowed some design elements from that. So it's very interesting, like, how some designs get used, reused, reformatted, and then borrowed again, and sometimes thrown away. I really want to know what else they're going to have on display, but I don't think I'll find the time to visit again.
Yeah, if I could, I'd go every week, but...
It's actually, yeah, it's not that expensive to go in, right? Yeah.
And this is one of the great things about, well, it's good and bad about events in Japan is, unless you go to the event, a lot of the things you'll never see again.
Right,
like
exactly.
Music culture, yeah. Bike helmets.
Yeah, especially because they don't even allow video or movies or photographs or anything.
Yeah, in fact, this doujin right here is one of the few places where that bike helmet design is preserved.
Yeah, and how did this guy must have gone every performance to have remembered the design. Because this is not in any book or anything.
They didn't have a program for that or anything?
Yeah, they did, but...
In the pictures?
I don't remember seeing the armor like that.
Huh. Okay, anyway, so... Sketchley has just walked in, and I've never met him before, so let me do my self-introduction. Hi, my name's Renato.
Nice to meet you.
Sketchley. This is my wife, Chie.
Nice to meet you.
So, we're just doing a mini 5-minute thing that has been going on for 15 minutes.
I can fix it in post.
Yeah. We will, yeah. Do you mind doing a very, very brief, it can be as extensive as you like, self-introduction?
My name is Aaron Sketchley. I've been in Japan for 10 years or so, and I'm, of course, a big Macross fan and originally introduced to it through Robotech.
The R word.
Yeah. But, of course, because of the things that got cut out of the, what is it, Robotech when it was Americanized, I never felt satisfied with it and decided to learn Japanese and pursue that, and that's why I came here and been here now 10 years, married with 3 kids, so I don't have as much time as I'd like to spend on hobbies. And
yeah, I'm learning that.
Yeah.
So Macross is the reason you came to Japan?
Yes. In, I guess you could say at the very, very beginning, but after life happens, it's not the only reason, of course.
Of course, yeah. Yeah. It's not the reason you stay. Yeah.
Of course not.
That's good. Okay.
All right. Pass it back to you.
Yeah. Well, let's do Kanpai, right? Because I got my heart and soul. You've got your Milan, and you have Asahibi. All right. Kanpai. Kanpai. Okay. Aaron, I'll just call you Aaron, is that okay? Yeah, alright. So, where are you from originally?
Originally from Victoria, BC, Canada.
Oh, Canada, okay.
Yes.
Sounds American.
Well, to me, definitely. I mean, yeah. I'm not.
I'm just saying.
Yeah. Okay.
San Francisco, apparently, Calgary, Vancouver,
Hey, close enough.
Close enough, still.
I've also been here for 10 years, too, so I don't really remember what people sound like.
But, gets dropped out of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you see that show, and it's one of those things that makes you go, what the hell's wrong with this country? Why can't we make something cool like that? You want to learn what crazy, strange place could make this awesome thing. And then you see the Masters, and you're like, oh, forget it, never mind. And then you get exposed to the original, and you're like, oh, those bastards. And then, you move on. But yeah, I mean, Macross and Ava and, all the other Japanese pop culture that started booming right when I was graduating college, that ended me up here. I mean, long, long after I graduated college, not right away, but eventually. And yeah. So I'm here for the long haul. Permanent resident.
Permanent resident?
Yep.
Yeah, me too. As of like last year. Yay!
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
And of course,
you were born here.
The real permanent resident.
Yeah. Was there anything else that you guys want to talk about since we're here? I mean, we can just chat after this recording is finished. Is there anything you want to...
This is the best place.
This is the best. I love this place. And I love Okamoto-san. Okamoto-san. We love you.
We love you.
しかもこれはノンアルコールですからね。だから本当の気持ちです。
He's high on Macross.
だから本当の気持ちです。 酔ってないです。 Okamoto-san大好き。
すいません。 バサラ焼酎水割り。 すいません。お湯割り。
水割り。
まだまだ。 勉強中。
バリバリ日本語喋れます。
What are you wearing? You're like it's a Punisher Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah.
I've never seen a Punisher Hawaiian shirt before.
Yeah.
You wear it to work?
Oh, no. I work at kindergarten, so no. But, yeah.
You're going to punish those kids.
That'd be a quick way on being not being able to afford any new Macross stuff. But who are those? This? No. I didn't come from work. I went home. If I rolled in like this, they'd be,
We'd like a word.
You can go home. Forever. But yeah, I guess we've really, really gone down the rabbit hole with this one. So yeah, Macross. How about that Macross?
Macross is great. We were just talking about how Macross is great because last week we went to a tribute concert with all these amateur bands. Like I imagine some of them are just like pros, but are minor bands, indie bands. They all get together and do some like in costume, right? In costume, yeah, yeah. They do. Fire Bomber songs and Milan songs and Midnight songs and stuff like that and Frontier songs, and it was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm not, you know, I like music, I love music, but you know, sometimes they don't hit quite the right chord for me.
Mm-hmm.
Not literally, I just mean that it's not to my taste, but this was great. Even the songs that I generally don't really care for that much,
mm-hmm.
They all sounded fantastic.
Yeah.
But we already podcast about that, so Gwyn's going to edit that and talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Yeah, nothing like that here. I mean,
when you guys come over,
wasteland. We've got Fire Bomber. This is our oasis.
Yeah.
They sometimes have theme nights here, right?
Yeah, but those are the revolving. You know, hi, buy some crap. I mean, I'm not impressed with those, and I would not. If I wasn't already going out, I wouldn't go to one. Except for that Kyoto one, with the. The Ranka in the kimono.
The pictures with
woodblock print sold out in 5 seconds, was restocked in the middle of the week, sold out in 2 seconds, and is now more expensive than plutonium. So, thank you. But yeah.
Those were good. I mean, those looked really, really, really artistic.
Mm-hmm. Really, really well done. I mean, the last time I went to one of those was with Adrian and Gwyn and Howard, and it was Alto's birthday. Yeah,
I heard about that. Yeah, it's like,
yeah, that was. Aww. Let's just call that disappointment. I mean, you know, you go there and it's all these like 17 to 22 year old girls figuring out which poster, which clear file, which bookmark is the cutest one.
But you know what's cool about that is that even though I'm not into it.
Like, I don't want to be into it. I'm happy to know that there are these girls out there loving Macross.
Right, exactly.
I don't want to be around them loving Macross.
That's what it is for me. I mean,
yeah.
It's I feel like that I'm not part of that user base anymore, but I am very, very happy that there is a brand new user base that is young and there's sometimes events where you can actually hang out.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and you know,
cultural exchange.
I remember being walking in front of the first movie, mm-hmm. Frontier movie,
yeah.
And having the gachapon, and I put in my 200 yen. And I'm like, it's like Cheryl's Taiyaki, and it's Aikun, and all these doll things, and then one Alto. Yeah. It's a little chibi Alto.
Yeah.
And I said, ah, come on, anything but Alto. Ah, Alto. Oops, sorry. Oh, you can bleep that. And so I go to the bathroom, and I'm coming back, and I'm watching two college-age girls, high school, college, I can't tell. Looking at this bank of them, and it's like there's six of the same machine, and like, which one will have the Alto one come out? And they're discussing, oh, this one, well, maybe this one, I don't know, oh, I don't know which one, because they really wanted the Alto one. I really just should have said, here, you can have mine, but I just kind of was translating my head as I walked by and said, oh, they want the Alto one? Oh, I guess that makes sense.
Is that the end of the story? I thought you were going to say. Oh, yeah,
No, I'm not that cool. I'm not that cool.
And then they were so happy.
I'm not that cool.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Disappointment.
And the moral of the story is, run away.
Yeah, I guess.
Okay. Well, anyway, it's like, yeah, I mean, I had like kind of similar experience.
Arigato.
I went to see the second Frontier movie. And you know, it was like the the second or third showing that day or something. So there was a group of people coming out just before we were going to go in, and they were all crying, like all these girls, like teenage girls and like 20 somethings.
What?
Yeah, they were like, Alto Queen. And I was with my friend looking at each other going,
are you trolling me, bro?
No.
Seriously?
Yeah, they were crying. And I'm like, what kind of a movie are we going to watch? I thought it was just like giant robots fighting each other. And went to watch it, and I'm like, I get it, okay? Yeah. Like, I don't have the emotional attachment to these characters that they probably do, but, you know, they are doing exactly what they want to do. You know what I mean? They're targeting the specific audience, and they're hitting the bullseye completely. Because there is a huge emotional response to these characters and their world, and the music and the merchandising that ties into it. So it's really, really successful. I'm actually, for, in that sense alone, I'm looking forward to the new series and what kind of new ideas and new people that's going to bring in, right?
I think it'd be fantastic.
It's probably still, or maybe, again, not going to be my kind of show, but you know, I'm okay with that now. I'm over it. It's fun to be part of this.
You know, if you pitched Lacrosse Frontier to me as, well, it's this thing, and all these emotional characters, and the women really love it. There's something there for everybody. I'd probably be like, yeah, okay, all right, like maybe I'll watch it. But you just put it in front of me and show it to me. I loved it.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, you realize later that it is that thing, and that's a great thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's the Macross Frontier specifically, just because it's the new modern way of trying to separate as many people from as much money as possible. they know that they you can't leave the Fujoshi and the girl and the female fans. They've got wallets, and you don't want to leave that money on the table. You want to get everything.
What do you say to people who are like, well, it's just pandering to the fanboys and fangirls?
It's
not necessarily in that tone.
Yeah, it's pandering. It's only pandering if it's poorly done.
Yeah.
If it's well done, and if it does actually satisfy all the fans, then it's just great.
I'll tell you what. I went in for the robots. I came out with a Nyan Nyan teapot. Okay? So
the exact same one they have?
Yeah, probably. How many did they make? They probably made a ton. I don't know.
It's the Coogee Prize, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They made 50,000 tons of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
no, exactly. That's kind of exactly what I'm saying. Is you come for the robots and you stay for literally everything else.
Yeah.
And if you come for the robots and stay only for the robots, it's just kind of sad.
Yeah. It's like you can do that, you know? It's okay.
Hey, you can do whatever you want.
But just, you know, sit in the corner with your...
You can come for the pretty boys and stay for the pretty boys, and that's fine, too.
Yeah.
Not you particularly.
Well,
you know, hey, you can do that, too.
Hey, yeah. Boys.
Even beyond that, just getting the genders, it's interesting that the way the Frontier is written to appeal to your sensibilities, with the fact that I've been listening to the Frontier podcast, not the Frontier, the Speaker podcast. I'm sorry, I am drinking alcohol. I'm like Renato, and when I hear people talk about what they take from the show, I realize that what they bring to the show as a viewer informs what they're going to get.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an older fan. I've been married. I've been divorced. And I see Cheryl, and I would chew my arm off to get away from her. But I listen to other people who are Cheryl fans, and they're younger, and they're more maybe not. They're more idealistic, and they've got this idea, and they come to it, oh, Cheryl's awesome, she's the best. And I'm like, well, I totally see that.
Yeah.
Well, and it's not all caps, wall of text, Ronka sucks, I love Cheryl, she's my waifu. That's stupid, but when you hear people talk and actually explain what they mean, it makes sense. And, you know, I'm a Ronka fan. I don't want to date Ronka. Ronka's a little girl. I wanted a daughter. I have a daughter. I have my own little Ronka at home. And that's why Ronka's special to me, because she's the girl you want to support, the girl you want to see her win, you want to see her succeed. Now, Cheryl, yeah, I don't care about Cheryl. I hate her as a person, but that's what makes her a great character, and I love her as a character. But that's just me.
Well, I'm in the same boat.
Okay, well, me and Aaron. I've been just chap, chap, chap. Yeah, let's... Here. What do you think?
Oh, I, as I said, I'm in the same boat. Oh,
okay.
That's it. There you go.
Okay, well, I think, unless Howard, you want to have something to add?
Come on, add something. Everybody's all doing right. It.
Yeah.
Unless I'm just going to turn this up and we just relax.
Yeah, I really like the fact that it's a different Macross every time.
Mm, exactly.
Yeah. Even though
it's never the same show twice, right. Definitely.
Damn.
Even though Macross Plus is my favorite, I wouldn't want them to just keep on churning out new Macrosses Pluses with a YF-37, a YF-59, and the same thing over and over. I like the fact that I can be surprised and do something different. I can go back and rewatch Macross Plus whenever I want, if that's what I want. But I want to see something different. And I'm looking forward to seeing something completely different next year.
Exactly.
Yeah.
My actually biggest fear is that it won't be something different, is that it'll just kind of ape Frontier so as to hit all the buttons at the same time. And I want it to be more different, so that I get something completely new.
Well, you know, I mean, Calamari is pretty good at that kind of thing, because I don't know if you've been keeping up with Aquarian.
I just have no interest in Aquarian.
Aquarian is a different show all the time, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a testament of, you know, you got a few building blocks, and you can. It's kind of like the Aquarian itself, you know. You can take the elements and rearrange them in any way you want, and make a new show every time, right? And you never know what you're gonna get. So I think that's the way Kamori works. Depends on what new concept he's come up with this time. So it's kind of just wait and see. But one thing is for sure, they're gonna market the hell out of this show,
yeah,
and probably gonna bring in new audiences. You know, the people who, yeah, like, so the people who are performing at this event that I was telling you about last week, they're in their, I don't know, I guess maybe the youngest are in their late teens, maybe early 20s, which means that they were in middle or high school while Frontier was airing, right? Mm-hmm. That influenced them a lot. As you said, yeah. It informed them a lot, right?
Exactly.
And they brought in this thing. So there's a new generation who's going to watch this show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sure that in another 10 years, we'll still be talking about this new show that's going to appear.
Matt, so, Protoculture willing.
Yeah, well, I'm...
sorry, that was real dark.
Which version of Protoculture...
Well, you pronounced it wrong. It's supposed to be proto-culture, not protoculture.
I've been drinking.
All right, I'm sure we've taken this as far as we can. All right, so thank you very much. I will now hand it over to whatever corner we're going to mix this thing up with. Back to Tokyo, falling out.